Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be continuing my conversation with Scott Billington, whose new book is Making Tracks, A Record Producer's Southern Roots Music Journey. We'll also hear from Nick Courage, whose new young adult novel is Snowstruck. I began my conversation with Grammy winner Scott Billington last week. You can find it at WWNO.org. Today, we continue our discussion of his terrific book, Making Tracks, A Record Producer's Southern Roots Music Journey. In his introduction, Peter Goralnik talks about some of his favorite stories. And my favorite story in this book is Bojack's story.
Mm.
And I wonder if you talk a little bit about him. He was the first Zydeco musician I ever met face-to-face, and it was in one of those little hallways at the Rock and Bowl, you know, and I'd gone to see him, and all of a sudden, there he was in all his gigantic talent and wonder, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
And I was speechless. He was a magnificent musician and unforgettable. So talk about getting to know him.
He was a very charismatic man, wasn't he?
Wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, I actually got to know him because of Kermit Richard at Richard's Club in Lautel, mm-hmm. Louisiana, which was one of the big Zydeco dance halls of the 80s and 90s. It had been a stop on the Chitlin' circuit for R&B artists in the 50s and 60s when Kermit Richard's parents ran the place. And Kermit called me up out of the blue one day and he said, "Scott, man, you got to come down here because Bojack is hot as a firecracker, and I know you're gonna have a good success if you sign Bojack." So I said, "Well, Kermit, this is great. Thank you so much." And I called Bojack. His real name was Andrus Espre.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very soft-spoken. And he said, "Well, I think I would be interested in making a record with you. You know, maybe we can meet the next time you come down to the area." So I was in Lafayette maybe within 2 or 3 weeks. I went to see him at a club called the Quarterback Lounge, kind of a hangout for oil industry workers. And here was this giant of a man with this little diatonic accordion with an extra bellows put on it, so it would pull out twice as far as any other accordion with this double bellows, with this absolutely intense funk groove going down.
Yeah.
And he was singing like Howlin' Wolf. I mean, it was just astonishing. My jaw dropped when I heard it. I'd never heard anything like that in Zydeco before. So we talked afterwards, and he was like, "Well, yes, let's make a record, you know?" So we're...
Thank you very much.
Yeah. He had made an EP of his own at that point, but we were soon on our way to Ultrasonic Studio in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. We rehearsed at Richard's Club. It was like capturing fire onto tape when those guys started playing in the studio. And he played it like he was playing a dance. Now, there's lots of ways to make records. You can lay down sounds one at a time and just build up something. You can cut a track live and then add horns and do the vocals and so forth. You can program the whole track. You can start with a loop and build your track on that. But this was the band in the studio firing on all 8 cylinders. I remember David Farrell, the engineer, turning to me and he just said, "Man, I've never heard Zydeco that sounds like this. I mean, this is... So I think we added a few background vocals to that just to kind of bring the energy up to another the level that you heard in the show with the musicians, mm-hmm. kind of shouting along with Bojack and
Skeeter.
Yeah, Skeeter, the drummer. Man, they had quite a rapport, didn't they?
I love that so much.
get it, Bojack.
You can't be depressed. You cannot be depressed when you listen to this music.
No.
It's an amazing.
So he became a huge star in South Louisiana and East Texas at Richard's Club. There were cars lined up and down US 190 for a half a mile in each direction, and it was quite a scene. He ended up on the David Letterman show and on Conan O'Brien. I went to Conan O'Brien with him.
That must have been fun.
It was really fun, and they played great, but the day before the flight, to New York, he called me up and says, man, you know, I got this gig at a chemical factory in Port Arthur, and, it's $10,000 for this gig. You know, do you think we can reschedule this? It's like, no. Beaujean, come on, man. You got to do this.
I could just hear you being persuasive, thinking, how am I going to do this now? Oh, man.
But he was a wonderful musician and a brilliant improviser. A lot of what he played was just on-the-spot improvisation. He'd have a little framework of what the song was about, but then he would just take it.
And such energy with the people.
Absolutely.
You know, mm-hmm. always. It was just, you felt he saw you. You felt he was singing to you.
Yeah.
It was really,
yep.
You know. And then you felt jazzed up. Another session you described that was very nearly perfect, this was a funny story to me, was the Delafos sessions.
Oh,
in the
John
quarter.
Delafos, yeah.
John
yeah.
Delafos, and
yeah.
they're like, you were ready to do some more work.
Yeah,
but
well,
no.
I met John also at Richard's Club. We'd done a little live recording at Richard's with four different bands, and I asked him if he'd like to make a studio record, and he was enthusiastic. He said yes, so we booked 3 days at Ultrasonic Studio in New Orleans to cut the record, and I got hotel rooms for the band, and I called him up and told him all of this, and he said, well, that sounds good, but I don't know about that, you know. I was thinking, oh, man, I guess I'm not paying him enough money. Or he says, no, we'll be there. Don't worry. So on the first day of the session, they showed up at about noon, and we more or less had everything set up. We had a particular place for the rubboard player to go, and we had a whole miking setup for the accordion and so forth that was set up and ready to go. But it took us probably an hour and a half or 2 hours to get all of the sounds ready to record. He was very impatient. He just wanted to record. So we finally got the tape rolling, and over the next hour and a half or 2 hours, he laid down 22 songs.
22? My gosh.
Like he was playing a dance, and it was really good. The energy, the song selection itself, I mean, we'd gone over it a little bit before he came to the studio, but half in French, half in English. Later on, when the record came out, I actually got a compliment from Chris Strachwitz about it, one of my heroes at Arhuli Records, who had also recorded John Delafos. And he says, man, you got it this time. Anyway, we finished 22 songs, and I went out and shook John's hand, and I said, I don't know if you realize what you just did, but that's really an accomplishment. Not too many musicians could make that record of that kind of quality that quickly with that great energy. I'd asked him to do one of the songs over again because the bass player had blown the changes going into the bridge, and he said, well, I don't know, we're going to do it just the same way. It's just, you know, they didn't the next time Tony hit the right note. But anyway, I said, man, just stick around if you can for an hour or so. I'll give you some rough mixes. You can listen to them on the way home. He said, no, well, that's okay. You can send them to me because we got to go home and feed the horses. So
he was done.
He was done. I mean, and that's such a refreshing attitude in a way of a musician who was not self-conscious about what they're doing. He knew he was good.
Right.
He knew what he did. He wasn't expecting any more or less than a fairly high quality of music that he usually played. I mean, I think a session like that in a way is an anomaly because usually there are a lot more pieces and parts to put together. But now when somebody asks me, how long does it take a record? I said, well, you can make a really great record in 4 or 5 hours, you know,
right.
Or you can
22
spend,
songs.
You can spend 4 or 5 months too. Yeah.
So I'm curious to know what you think about this, because it's often occurred to me how interesting it is that the talent seems to run in families in Louisiana, in writing and in music.
Sure.
So talk a little bit about that whole overall way it's supported by communities, families.
Yeah, I think in New Orleans there are so many families like that. The Marsalis family, of course, comes to mind first. But if you think back to Danny Barker and the Barbaran family, you know, Paul Barbaran, who wrote Bourbon Street Parade, and Lucien Barbaran, the trombone player, who just tragically died way too young. Herlin Riley is part of that family.
Yeah,
that extended family. In South Louisiana, the Williams family, Nathan Williams Jr. and Nathan Williams Sr. are both big stars on the Zydeco circuit now. I think in some ways, I got this impression in particular from reading Danny Barker's book, My Life in Jazz, that music can be looked at as a profession. And maybe not so much in some other parts of the country, but in New Orleans, and particularly the traditional brass bands and traditional jazz, you had to develop a certain skill set in order to get jobs. That's still true to this day. But I think for a child to grow up in that kind of family environment where the music was prized not only for the art that was being made, but just for the nuts and bolts profession that it would offer somebody. When you combine the experience that a child would have with music in general in New Orleans on the street, and the music you hear during Carnival, the gospel music, the Mardi Gras Indians in the street, mm-hmm. along with a supportive family environment that says, yes, you can do this too, you're next in line for this, it kind of makes sense to me that there would be an extension of family legacy going on like that.
And the sense of an apprenticeship. The apprenticeships are there to be had and there to be earned. And
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, there are older, you know, there are ancestors there ready to help you.
Yeah, yeah.
So talk a little bit about producing a record. It seems to me it's kind of an art and a craft. You know, there are certain basics you have to have. You have to know certain things, technical mm-hmm. things. But there's a point where your vision enters into it as well, and what you've heard, what you think you hear in the music. Gifts that only you can bring, for example. So how would you describe that?
Well, I think you're right. It is an art and a craft. I think of the producer of a record in the same way as you might think of the director of a film.
Or the editor of a book.
Bringing together the cast, bringing together the musicians and the songs. And I certainly try to approach each record with a vision, but it's a vision of something I hear. Like, I can really hear this artist in this setting doing these songs. I hope I can get them there. And if I've made the right decision in working with this artist, then hopefully we share the same vision and can go there together, because really I'm there to support the artist. Mm-hmm. And my friend Dan Penn, the songwriter, said once, you know, when I produce a record, I like to think of everything possible that would make the artist feel good about being where they are, giving them everything they need to be their best. And I think that's a good way to think of record production or music production. Because some artists might need songs. Mm-hmm. Maybe they would need help in imagining the story that a record might tell. And we go from the beginning to the end. Now we're in an era of the track today, but when you're making albums, you might want the whole album to tell a particular story.
Those were the days when people would sit down and listen with great attention.
Yeah, you would sit there and be quiet for an hour and listen. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's all those things. And then there's the technical aspect of it, of mm-hmm. making sure that every instrument sounds good, that the mix is good, that the emotion of the performance is not hindered by the technology in any way, and hopefully enhanced by the technology. I've always been lucky to work with some really good engineers, and I tend to lean on them more than doing it myself. David Farrell in New Orleans, Steve Reynolds, in particular those two. But there is... where you put the microphone is really important in relationship mm-hmm. to somebody's voice or to the sound of a saxophone or whatever. So all these things have to add up. So when we're in session, my first responsibility is to be paying attention to the artist. If there's a singer, maybe it's a band, and really just listening to everybody and trying to keep everybody on the most positive track and picking up on what's working and encouraging that mm-hmm. and maybe gently steering somebody away from what I don't think is working. I think the best educational experience that I ever had in terms of record production was an ear training class that I took with a guy named Rand Blake at the New England Conservatory of Music. He was the third stream department head there, kind of this fusion of jazz and classical music. Mm-hmm. So he taught me all of these melodies that I had to come back and sing to him each week. Or if I wanted, I could play it on the chromatic harmonica, either one.
Wow.
So, and they all had these little harmonic tricks in them. You know, your ear would want to go one place, but actually the melody went someplace else. So you had to really teach yourself to hear and be able to sing it back. Mm-hmm. So listening in the moment and being able to give some feedback on what's going on is really important in record production. And if it's going good, you just don't say anything. You just sit back and smile.
Yeah. Thank you. We've been talking with Scott Billington, Renaissance Man, whose new book is Making Tracks, A Record Producer's Southern Roots Musical Journey, and we're glad he took it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Susan. Thank you. Thank you.
Nick Courage was born in New Orleans and now lives in Pittsburgh, where he writes young adult novels, skateboards and bikes, and bakes. Bakes really fancy things, too. His books so far are The Loudness, Stormblown, A Hurricane Story That Feels All Too Real, and now Snowstruck, about a winter storm and how it affects a group of people and animals in New York City over the Christmas holiday. It is just the chilly thing young readers need for hot summer months. Nick Courage, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan.
Wow, I mean, what an action-packed book this is.
Well, you know, when you're writing for young readers, you really have to think about reluctant readers, so you have to kind of get things moving fast and keep it chugging along.
Well, it feels like a skateboard ride to me. I mean, so tell us what's happening. Elizabeth and her younger brother, Maddie, have left their home in Georgia, where their parents are rebuilding their home after a storm, to visit their New York City cousins over the holidays. And when they arrive in the Big Apple, things are just not what they thought they'd be. So what goes on from there?
Right. So Snowstruck is the story of a massive winter storm hitting the eastern seaboard and some of the unsuspecting kids and animals that are caught in its path. And my two main protagonists, Maddie and Elizabeth, go visit their cousin Ashley in New York City, and it's unseasonably warm. And the sort of trick of the story is that unseasonable warmth leads to massive, massive cold, which is sort of counterintuitive. Why would a super hot winter turn into record cold? And essentially the trick of the story is that heat wave weakens the polar vortex and sends a bunch of cold air south from the Arctic. And then from there, it's just the story of the blizzard of the century.
Well, Arctic weather is just so interesting anyway, especially to those of us who live in the South.
Yeah.
So you're carving this wonderful kind of niche for yourself in eco-fiction.
Yeah.
Talk about the research for the scientific facts behind this book.
Oh, so much research. It's funny, when you write children's literature, a lot of people think you just kind of sit down and take you wherever your whimsy leads you. Right. So for these kinds of books, when you're doing science writing, I go to the library and I take out, without exaggeration, 40, 60 books. I'll go to the section that has one book on ice for this book specifically, and then take out the entire shelf of winter books and start reading about Shackleton explorations, about formation of ice, all the interesting things that can happen to weather. And then the first draft of a book like this is just incredibly science-y, too much science almost to be readable for the age range that I'm writing for. And that's sort of me trying to learn the science and synthesize it into a story. And then the second draft is me sort of saying, okay, I need some plot to go with all this interesting science stuff.
Well, one of the interesting qualities of your writing is that you have so many points of view. That's become one of your signatures. And one point of view that's especially interesting is that of Joy, who is a scientist on a mission.
Yeah, so when I write about extreme weather events, I really want to feel like it's not one person who's experiencing the weather event or the story, or one person who's affected by it. I feel like we sort of naturally center our experiences of weather events, extreme weather events, on ourselves, my city, my street, what happened over here. And then sort of after the storm, we forget about the other places that it has impacted, or the other people or animals that have been impacted by it. So I want to create as much empathy around extreme weather events as possible. And so that means writing lots of kids, some adults, some animals. For Joy, Joy is the one character who was also in my last book, Stormblown.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm writing about extreme weather events, when I was thinking about who do I call in this chapter to help the kids who are reading learn more about what's happening with these extreme weather events, who's the voice of authority, I just love Joy so much that I thought she has to be in this book too.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Now, another point of view belongs to a very small dog in that very big storm. And that's another thing you've done so well for yourself is create these animal characters who tug at our hearts.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was doing school visits for Stormblown, I learned that kids really, really, really like the animal point of views. And I think they like them also because I try really hard not to anthropomorphize the animals.
So right.
In Stormblown, I have a turtle. And I don't want to give any spoilers away, but what would a turtle actually feel if it was being evacuated in a helicopter? And writing those scenes is really fun. In this book, I have an Arctic fox, I have deer, I have this Pomeranian named Fang. And kids really want to know what happens to the animals. It's almost like a Holden Caulfield thing, you know, what happens to the ducks in the winter when the lake freezes over? I remember one school visit in Denham Springs, I was talking about Stormblown, and one kid raised their hands and said, well, we know about the turtle, but what happens to worms? And that got me thinking, you know, like, oh, I got to, like, really explore what happens to all these different animals during an extreme weather event like a blizzard. And that's a lot of research as well.
Now, one of the other great things about your book, well, all your books, is that they show how tough young people can be. And the lesson, without being preachy, is never give up.
Yeah, yeah. So for Stormblown and Snowstruck, I like to write about ordinary kids in extraordinary circumstances. So my protagonists aren't kids who have some special power or like jumping from building to building. They're really just regular kids. And I want the books to feel like something that could believably happen to a regular kid, in part because kids need a safe place to sort of explore the things they're worried about. And kids are really worried about extreme weather events. When I do school visits across the country, now Zoom visits across the country, I always ask, who here has experienced an extreme weather event? And whether it's hurricanes or wildfires or blizzards or tornadoes or flooding, almost every class, every kid puts their hand up. So
wow.
I want to create a book where they can explore those extreme weather events, but it's also sort of a fun place to do it. I feel like a lot of the discourse about weather can feel so fraught and politicized and also really dense. So I think it's just really important for young readers to have a safe place to really picture themselves as a protagonist in these scary events.
Now, you're a wonderful writer about adventure, you know, and you have wonderful pacing in your book. And I wonder, what would you call your biggest adventure? You dedicate this book to your wife with a pretty provocative description.
Yeah, so, this was before I met her, but she did snowboard off an Alp on a hang glider, which, even as she explains it to me, you know, well, I was attached to somebody who did it with me. It just seemed so wild. She wants to snowboard. So, yeah, all my books so far have been dedicated to my wife, Rachel, and she is just so cool. And I just needed to put it out in the world that she did snowboard off and out on hang glider. My biggest adventure? That's a good question. I have to think about that. I feel like one of my biggest adventures is just sort of becoming a writer and learning how to write books that are interesting for kids and incorporating sort of my own experiences, synthesizing them into novels that hopefully make kids sort of more curious about the world and feel better about themselves.
We've been talking with Nick Courage, whose new novel is Snowstruck, a thriller about climate change for young writers that readers of any age can enjoy. Be sure to check out his website, nickcourage.com. Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Novelist Diane C. McPhail appears in conversation with Sue Strachan to discuss The Seamstress of New Orleans, Tuesday, May 31st at 5:30 at the Spire Center, 1772 Britannia Street. Clay McLeod reads from and signs his horror novel, Whisper Down the Lane, Friday, June 3rd at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. Blue Cypress hosts a launch event for the New Orleans Art Rag, a new arts journal that focuses on Louisiana creators, Friday, June 3rd from 6 to 7:30. That great annual event, the Symphony Book Fair, is coming up Friday, June 3rd through Sunday, June 5th at the University of New Orleans Lakefront Arena. Enter the sale under Ramp 1, which faces Franklin Avenue. Hours are Friday from 9 to 8, with admission from 9 to 3 only. Free admission after 3, and then Saturday 9 to 8 and Sunday 9 to 4 with free admission both days. Books include fiction and nonfiction in 50 categories, sheet music and recordings, LPs, CDs, DVDs, and audiobooks. And in art, there will be both posters and original works, as well as a special children's sale Sunday from 11 to 2. Proceeds support the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. The 7th Annual Walker Percy Weekend takes place June 3rd through 5th in St. Francisville. Go complete with beer, bourbon, barbecue, and lots of great conversation. Check out walkerpercyweekend.org for tickets. New additions to the schedule include a screening of Jason Barry's film, City of a Million Dreams. Speakers this year include Chris Baglow of Notre Dame University, Jody Blanco, co-author of I, John Kennedy Toole, a novel that traces the origins of a Confederacy of Dunces, John Sheldon Reed, author of 22 books, most recently on barbecue, and Reed Mercer Shushart, who will discuss the many movies of the moviegoer. And coming up at the June Writers Seminar, Sex and Voodoo at the Library. Two New Orleans authors present sessions to help local writers be better at their craft, Saturday, June 11th from 9:30 to 12:30 at the North Kenner Library, 630 Esplanade in Kenner. Each is free of charge and open to the public. No registration. Mystery writer Greg Herron discusses how to write a sex scene and when not to at 9:30 a.m., followed by Kalila Smith discussing what every writer should know about voodoo and the occult at 11 a.m. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.